Chapter 8. Body Politics. In the 1960s, the politics of the body entered the body politic. For the last several thousand years, control of the body, that is, woman's body, has been a central concern of many of the religious, social, and political doctrines and institutions created by man. There would have been no need to write a history of misogyny if this were not the case. However, deep within the male psyche are the wellsprings of fear and fascination that contemplation of woman causes. Her dehumanization, either through elevation or denigration, was always, broadly speaking, a political matter. That is, the politics of the body was not invented in the 1960s, but it was not until the middle of the 20th century that women themselves had the power to shape how the politics of the body would be defined. At that point, a technological breakthrough and the resurgence of feminism combined to force the issue into the public sphere as never before. The first half of that century had seen in the Western and developed nations, outside of the totalitarian sphere, women winning political, legal, and social rights. In the decades following, the struggle would shift to a far more profound arena, the right of women to control their own fertility as the technology to do so became increasingly sophisticated, reliable, and available. It was a battle for the ultimate mechanism of control within a woman's body, her reproductive cycle. For a woman, this right is the most crucial of all, and the key to achieving real autonomy. Misogyny denies her that autonomy. Her subordination depends on her lack of it. As the sexual revolution unfolded in the West, misogyny was faced with its worst nightmare. It would not be found wanting in the virulence of its response to the challenge. The idea of women having sex without risking pregnancy is deeply disturbing to the vision of woman's role that Western civilization has inherited from the Judeo-Christian tradition, which at its heart is profoundly misogynistic. In Britain, the Anglican Church denounced it as the awful heresy. As families grew smaller in the US during the early years of the 20th century, with the average woman bearing around 3 children by 1900 as compared with 7 in 1800, the moral reaction mounted. There was opposition from women themselves to contraception based on moral grounds. Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman in the US to earn a medical degree, claimed that using contraceptives to indulge a husband's sensuality while counteracting nature is on the one hand most uncertain of success and on the other hand is eminently noxious to woman. Theodore Roosevelt attacked the use of condoms as decadent. Anticipating the terms later used by the Nazis in their campaign to keep women barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen, he declared women who used contraceptives as criminals against the race, the object of contemptuous abhorrence by healthy people. Pregnancy, with its pains and sufferings, was preordained by God as part of the punishment, along with work and death, which Eve had incurred for her wicked inquisitiveness. Without the threat of pregnancy, women would have sex for pleasure and abandon their maternal responsibilities, becoming as selfish as men or worse, since the thought that women were sexually insatiable had never gone away and remained a source of male anxiety. The family, and therefore civilization, would collapse. For some, it was that simple. It made the demand for effective birth control far more threatening than the demand for the vote. Without effective birth control, equality for women would always be highly qualified. Opponents to the demand, in both church and state, were happy that it should remain so. They might trust woman with the vote, but not with the power to decide her reproductive fate. However, the demand for access to birth control would not become a major threat to society's domination of women as long as birth control methods remained clumsy, unreliable, unrefined, or just too plain embarrassing to use, as they were for most of human history, until, that is, the invention of the contraceptive pill in 1955. Before, men had women more or less at their mercy in deciding whether or not to employ condoms, the most common contraceptive device. In theory, of course, a woman could refuse to have intercourse with a man unless he wore one, but in practice, men bullied, coerced, blackmailed, or otherwise pressurized women into taking risks for the sake of the man's pleasure. They still do. But when the pill became widely available in the early 1960s, it meant that for the first time in human history, women could choose for themselves whether or not they wanted to regulate their fertility without having to consult the man with whom they were having sexual relations. The old system of male dominance, with its theories of misogyny, was more than just a reflection of property relationships, as Marx and Engels crudely maintained. It also rested on the biological subjugation of women to men, which was maintained in the absence or refusal of birth control measures to regulate the woman's fertility. This patriarchal system was remarkably successful, and still is in many parts of the world, and gave men the kind of sexual freedom that was denied to women. As the philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote, "Men who dominated had considerable liberty, and women who suffered were in such complete subjection that their unhappiness seemed not important." For the first time in the 1960s, the contraceptive pill threatened this ancient hierarchy and opened a vista of sexual equality. Traditionally, the women's movement had shied away from arguing for sexual equality for fear of deterring support among the respectable classes. In fact, birth control advocates in the early 1900s were more concerned with population control and regulating the poor, whose increasing numbers were viewed as a threat to social stability, than they were with levelling the sexual playing field between the sexes. If women's rights advocates argued in favour of sexual equality between men and women, it was generally to stress the need for men to respect the morality of monogamy that they had imposed upon women. They were firmly within the Christian moral tradition, which had 2,000 years earlier attracted women by regarding the adulterous husband as being as much of a sinner as the adulterous wife. The notion that equality could be secured through allowing women to behave as promiscuously as men was so defiant of the traditional code, as well as of certain biological realities, that the women's movement feared it would mark their own endeavours with the taint of bohemian radicalism. But with the advent of the pill, it now became physically possible for women to have sexual intercourse as casually as men without the fear of pregnancy if they so chose. The right to choose is, as always, the key to progress for women, as it is for men. Within 15 years of its introduction, 20 million women were exercising that right by taking the pill, and another 10 million were using the intrauterine device, or IUD. Misogyny seeks to dehumanize women through restrictive definitions of what their true role supposedly is, and in making sure they are confined to it. In Western civilization, there had been no more powerful apparatus for imposing such a definition than the Christian churches. But by the middle of the 20th century, their influence had considerably weakened in most parts of the West. Beginning in the 18th century, the Catholic Church, which perhaps has done more than any other institution in history to fashion how men viewed and treated women, went on an irreversible intellectual retreat. It had seen off the threat from the Reformation, but not the challenge of the Enlightenment and the subsequent scientific revolution. Instead of mounting a serious philosophical response to the scientific worldview, it sought refuge in saccharine simplicity. The Church's most effective propaganda weapon in the war to keep women in their place, the Virgin Mary, suddenly began appearing before the astonished eyes of peasant girls and boys in Portugal, France, and Ireland. Over 200 such visitations occurred, beginning in the 19th century, of which the Church authenticated only a handful, such as that in Lourdes, southern France. It continues to draw millions of believers every year. The Virgin was supposedly distressed by the lack of faith in the modern world, and her message was that only the Rosary can save mankind. The sightings followed Pope Pius IX's 1854 declaration of the dogma of Mary's Immaculate Conception, hailing her as the only human being ever conceived without original sin, and making this belief one of the essentials of the Catholic faith. The Church's response to the scientific revolution was to trust in a sentimental credulity and to proclaim its dogmas to be beyond and above reason. It was from this position that it would launch its attacks on contraception and abortion. The Church may have lost the intellectual argument with science, but it still wielded enormous moral influence over millions of believers, especially in the developing world, as it does to this day. It has used that influence to try and prevent women from gaining access to birth control measures, even in the poorest countries where such access is essential if there is to be some hope of escaping from the cycle of poverty and deprivation. The unnatural practice known as birth control is working havoc in the United States, wrote Father Orville Grease in 1944, a Jesuit and an authority on canon law and married life. If it continues at its present rate, the American people will not long survive. Unfortunately, most Americans are indifferent to the harmful effects of this loathsome vice. Indeed, the only organized attack on the crime of contraception is that which is being made by the Catholic Church. Father Grease argued that even if it meant certain death for the woman, it is undoubtedly sinful for her to perform the marriage act in a manner contrary to nature, that is, use a contraceptive device. In the early 1960s, in response to the call of many millions of Catholic women, especially in the US, who wanted to limit the size of their families through the use of contraception, a papal commission was set up to look at Catholic teaching on birth control in the light of current scientific knowledge. It found that there was no scriptural, theological, philosophical reason or basis in natural law for the Church's prohibition on birth control. Millions of Catholic couples heaved a sigh of relief in the expectation of the Church adopting a more liberal attitude. However, in 1968, Pope Paul VI responded instead with an encyclical Humanae Vitae. The encyclical reaffirmed the Church's rejectionist stance. Contraceptives were evil and against God's law. 10 years later, Pope John Paul II declared that Humanae Vitae was a matter of fundamental Catholic belief. In the West, many, if not most, Catholics ignored the ban. For them, however painful, the decision of whether to conceive or not was rarely a life-or-death issue. Unfortunately, for women in the poorest parts of the world, it often is. There, the right to choose whether or not to conceive was vitally linked to a woman's prospects for freeing herself and her family from poverty. It is in this context that the inherent and deeply rooted misogyny of the Church has taken its greatest toll on the lives of women. Pope John Paul II spent a considerable part of his pontificate propagandizing on behalf of a doctrine that tells poor and illiterate women that to use a condom is the moral equivalent of murder, and that each time they use contraceptives, they render Christ's sacrifice on the cross in vain. He said, "No personal or social circumstances have ever been able or will be able to rectify the moral wrong of the contraceptive act." Underlying this attitude is the assumption that when it comes to having a baby, a woman's consent is not necessary, and that once made pregnant, accidentally or not, her own will is rendered irrelevant. The moral implications of this are interesting when compared with those governing our attitudes to rape. All civilized societies accept that a woman's consent is necessary in order to have intercourse with her. Not to seek that consent and to coerce her into intercourse is to commit rape, which is a serious crime. But yet, according to the Church, in the vital matter of pregnancy, a woman's consent is beside the point. She can be made pregnant against her wishes and without her consent. The inexorable law of God overrides her will, and the fact that she is pregnant determines her fate. Her personal autonomy is denied her. To deny the need for her consent in this, the most important aspect of a woman's life, is surely the moral equivalent of justifying rape. It reminds us once more of the profound contempt that has underpinned Catholic attitudes towards women and that has been responsible for so much suffering down the centuries. Millions of women in the poorest countries who are the most vulnerable continue to suffer because of it. The Church discourages governments in Catholic countries from developing family planning facilities which are desperately needed where the population growth outstrips their economic development. In 1980, the Pope visited Brazil, the world's most populous Catholic country. For years, Brazil followed the Catholic doctrine and was opposed to family planning. Abortion was outlawed, with sentences ranging from 6 to 20 years for anyone convicted of carrying it out. As a result, millions of Brazilian women were forced to go to backstreet abortionists or to resort to knitting needles or coat hangers to terminate their unwanted pregnancies. It is estimated that about 50,000 women die each year there in botched efforts to end their pregnancies. However, 2 years after the Pope's visit, the government reversed its previous position and asked for help from the United Nations Population Fund, which aims to expand family planning aid to the poor nations who need it most. But abortion is still outlawed in Brazil and still kills more Brazilian women than anything else. Of course, it is the poorest women who suffer most. Brazil's rich elite has access to abortion without fear of arrest or social stigma. "Our law serves only to punish the poor," commented Elcimar Coutinho, the head of the Brazilian Family Planning Association. The Catholic Church is not the only powerful worldwide body or institution that is campaigning to curtail the access of the poorest and most vulnerable women to family planning facilities. In the 1980s, the United States government under President Ronald Reagan adopted a policy of denying funding to family planning groups that carry out abortion services or provide information about abortion. The policy was urged upon the government by lobbyists for fundamentalist Protestant organizations, which have grown in influence since the 1980s in U.S. politics. They are part of a conservative and religious backlash against the gains that women made in the 1960s and 1970s. By the congressional elections of 1994, 2 out of every 5 votes for the Republican Party came from the Christian right. President George W. Bush, whose core supporters are fundamentalists, revived the policy and declared war on abortion before his war against terrorism. On his very first day in office in 2001, he reinstated the gag rule against funding going to groups that provide abortion services and information about them. Hundreds of women's health organizations in some of the poorest countries in the world had to make the difficult choice of dropping their abortion services and counseling or lose their funding. One of those who refused to sign the gag rule was Amare Badada of the Ethiopian Family Guidance Association. He said that because of his refusal, 44 of the 54 family planning clinics in his region would probably be closed by 2004. Each serves about 500 women, some of whom have to walk 6 miles to reach them. The problems that his clinics deal with on a day-to-day basis include rape, forced marriage, and genital mutilation. "Under the gag rule, I can treat a woman who comes bleeding after an illegal abortion, but I am not allowed to warn her of the dangers before she goes," Mr. Badada said. "We should not be told what to think and say." He concluded, "The U.S. is driving women into the hands of backstreet abortionists." As of 1999, abortion was illegal in most Central and South American nations, except in cases of rape or incest or where the woman's life was at stake. The same restrictions apply in a majority of African states and in a large number of Middle Eastern and South Asian nations. In the mainly Catholic Irish Republic in 1983, an anti-abortion clause was put into the country's constitution. As a result of such restrictions, the World Health Organization estimates that around 70,000 women die every year because of having unsafe abortions, and many hundreds of thousands more suffer terrible infections or loss of fertility. This means that as many, if not more, women die each year because they are denied the right to choose than were murdered annually at the height of the European witch hunts in the 16th and 17th centuries. As then, the misogyny of Christianity is directly responsible for the major part of this unnecessary suffering. It may seem somewhat ironic that the Catholic Church finds itself advocating the same position against abortion as its severest Christian critics, the Protestant fundamentalists. In fact, it is no more surprising than finding the so-called pro-life movement keeping company with Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Chairman Mao, all of whom at one time or another banned abortions. What they have in common is their belief, rooted in misogyny, that the woman's right to choose, a fundamental aspect of her autonomy, must be crushed in order to achieve what they have deemed a higher religious, moral, or social goal. The campaign for the woman's right to choose has been among the most bitter and controversial struggles in the United States in the 20th century. it provoked the misogynistic backlash of the 1980s and 1990s, which at its most fanatical led to attacks on family planning clinics and the murders of doctors and healthcare workers. The ideological justification for this campaign sprang from the traditional misogyny of Christianity and its basic tenet that woman's subordination, her perceived inferiority, is God's judgment on her for her guilt in bringing about the fall of man. However, even the Catholic Church has not always been as completely intolerant of abortion as it is currently. Until 1588, the Church followed Aristotle's dictate that the fetus was not ensouled until 40 days after conception if it was male and 60 days if female. So abortion could, under certain circumstances, take place up until then. However, in that year, Pope Sixtus V decreed that abortion at whatever stage of conception was murder. The dogma of the Immaculate Conception proclaimed in 1854 further strengthened the Church's anti-abortion position because it assumed that Mary was ensouled as the only human free from original sin from the very first moment of her conception, which means that from that second onwards she was fully human. Pius IX reiterated that teaching in 1869. Just to make sure that there was no argument to the contrary, the next year he proclaimed the dogma of papal infallibility. Undoubtedly, the curve of rising intensity with which the Church proclaimed that abortion was murder kept pace with the rise in demands from women for birth control and the right to choose. It became the battlefield where the fate of the family itself would be determined. From the standpoint of the union of husband and wife, statistics have been gathered which show that divorce is practically non-existent among parents of large families, and they multiply as the number of children decrease. Nothing so develops the solidarity of husband and wife as the multitude of their children. Learned theologians would argue that without a large family to look after, a wife would become selfish, devote herself to gossip, to reading dangerous books, and hanging around with bad company. With the death of Stalin, abortion was legalized again in the Soviet Union in 1955, having been outlawed in 1936, and throughout the Soviet dependencies around the same time. Abortion was legalized in Britain in 1967, in the US 6 years later, in France in 1974, and in Italy in May 1978. However, it has mainly been in the US that the ruling in favor of choice has been met with such fierce, violent, and fanatical resistance, involving both Protestant fundamentalists and conservative Catholics. In the 1980s, when the number of abortions in the US peaked, an organization called Operation Rescue emerged to stage protests outside family planning clinics where abortion services were provided. Its members were mostly middle-aged or elderly men. Some protesters recited the rosary as women made their way into the clinics. Others waved models or pictures of mutilated fetuses. They chanted, "Abortion is murder, don't kill your baby," or screamed, "Baby killers," at doctors and staff. They made frequent comparisons between abortion and the Holocaust. The millions of aborted fetuses were compared to the mass murder of Jews under the Nazis. For many women already suffering stress because of the difficult decision they had made to end their pregnancy, to be exposed to this barrage of intimidation and abuse could be agonizing and traumatic. Religious authorities, from the Pope down, had for years been denouncing abortion as murder. Virtually every time a Catholic priest spoke from the pulpit about abortion, the words murder and murderer were heard issuing from his mouth. Protestant preachers were not far behind in the race to see who could come up with the most sensational, obscene, and cruel comparison between abortion and some real or imagined horror. Both Protestant and Catholic religious authorities frequently poisoned their rhetoric against a woman's right to choose with allusions to the Holocaust. The hysterical rhetoric of the protesters merely followed the example set by their mentors, as their verbal attacks on women took on the intensity of hate speech. The logic of this is inescapable. If women exercising their right to end a pregnancy and the medical staff who aid them are the moral equivalent of murderers and concentration camp administrators, then it follows that they should be punished as such. At least it did in the minds of those who took the hate speech literally. Among them was Michael Griffin, who shot dead Dr. David Gunn at an abortion clinic in Pensacola, Florida, in 1993. He inspired Paul Hill, a 40-year-old father of three and former Presbyterian minister, who was a frequent protester outside abortion clinics, where he would scream through the window, "Mommy, don't kill me!" Hill appeared on television, arguing on programs such as Nightline and Donahue, where he compared killing an abortion doctor with killing Hitler. On the 29th of July, 1994, as 69-year-old Dr. John Bayard, his driver James H. Barrett, a retired Air Force lieutenant, aged 74, along with Mr. Barrett's wife, pulled into the parking lot of the other abortion clinic in Pensacola, Hill opened fire on them with a 12-gauge shotgun. He killed Barrett first before shooting Dr. Bayard in the head. Hill explained later that he deliberately took aim at Dr. Bayard's head, knowing that the doctor was probably wearing a bulletproof vest. He also wounded Mrs. Barrett, who was crouching in terror in their vehicle. Hill surrendered, was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. On the evening of his execution, the 3rd of September 2003, a crowd of protesters gathered outside the prison in Stark, Florida. Some were opposed to the death penalty, some were there to support Hill, and others the right to choose. Some of the pro-Hill crowd's placards were an incitement to murder, if not hatred. "Dead doctors can't kill," said one. "Killing baby killers is justifiable homicide," proclaimed another. A protester told the New York Times that Hill had raised the standard for the anti-abortion movement. "Someday I hope I will have the courage to be as much of a man as he was," he said. At a news conference before he was executed, Hill spoke of his belief that the state will be making me a martyr. His last words were, "If you believe abortion is an evil force, you should oppose the force and do all you have to stop it." Between 1993 and 1998, those who, like Hill, followed the logic of the anti-choice campaign's violent rhetoric claimed the lives of seven abortion providers and employees of family planning clinics. In 2001, pro-life terrorists in Australia emulated their attacks and killed a security guard outside the fertility control clinic in East Melbourne. Of course, the Protestant and Catholic churches, as well as the mainstream anti-abortion organisations, were understandably quick to distance themselves from the killings. The paradox of an organisation claiming to be pro-life yet being identified with murder was a bit too glaring for all but the most fanatical to ignore. However, the pro-life movement cannot escape the moral consequences of the hate speech they commonly employ against the staff of the clinics and the women who use them. Nor can the fundamentalist Protestant and conservative Catholic leaders whose rhetoric describing abortion in terms of the Holocaust was surely instrumental in sending the killers out to murder in the name of life. Hill compared killing a doctor to killing Hitler. James C. Kopp, a 48-year-old convert to Catholicism, was convicted in May 2003 of the October 1998 murder of Dr. Barnett A. Slepian at his home near Buffalo, New York. In his statement to the court, Kopp compared Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, to Hitler, and said that abortion was the continuation of the Holocaust. It didn't end in 1945. He went on, "I hope that my younger brothers and sisters in the movement know that we can still cut some holes in the fences of the death camps and let a few babies crawl to safety." The image of babies, surely it should be fetuses, crawling through barbed wire fences is as bizarre as it is ludicrous, but given the context, not a surprising fantasy. Pro-life terrorism attracted an unsavory collection of bigots and misfits that throws light on the links between misogyny and other forms of hatred. In June 2003, Eric Robert Rudolph was charged with four bombing attacks between 1996 and 1998. They include a pipe bombing in a park hosting the Summer Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia, which killed a woman and injured 100 people, and a bombing outside an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, which took the life of an off-duty police officer who was acting as a guard. He was also connected to the bombing of a gay bar in Atlanta. Rudolf was a member of a white supremacist organization and an anti-Semite who complained that Jews had taken over the world. Rudolf remains something of a folk hero to the community of Murphy, North Carolina, where he was raised and where many people express support for his views. One resident of the town was quoted as asserting, "Rudolf's a Christian, and I'm a Christian, and he dedicated his life to fighting abortion. Those are our values." John A. Burt is a well-known anti-choice activist who has been charged on several occasions with organizing violent protests at birth control clinics in Florida. The family of Dr. Gunn, murdered in 1993, won a civil action against Burt, claiming that he prompted the man convicted of the murder, Michael Griffin, to carry out the killing. Burt is also a member of the Ku Klux Klan. In 2003, he was charged with sexually abusing a teenage girl. 30 years after the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling secured the right to choose for U.S. women, the so-called pro-life movement is still active in trying to roll back that victory and force women to return to the days of the coat hanger and the knitting needle. That some in that movement have at times resorted to terrorism is a reminder that misogyny, like any hatred or prejudice, can result in extreme violence. It is tempting to dismiss those who murder in the name of the pro-life movement as insane extremists. But comparing a desperate woman in need of an abortion to a genocidal Nazi, as church leaders have done, does not pass the test of sanity either. Yet such invidious comparisons remain essential to the dehumanizing rhetoric of right-wing religious and conservative spokespersons determined to keep women in their subordinate position. The politics of the body had even more deadly consequences in those areas of Africa, Asia, and the Middle East where the influence of the West had been felt since the 19th century. But paradoxically, it was frequently because of the West's attempt to impose more progressive and liberal values that challenged indigenous practices. In the wake of the Second World War, opposition to colonialism began to mount. Often that opposition took the form of defending customs and traditions that the colonialists attacked. Unfortunately, these were frequently customs that were injurious to women or that expressed indigenous misogynistic beliefs. Britain's efforts to prohibit sati, or widow burning, in India had created intense hostility to its rule. In the 1950s in Kenya, the British government's attempt to ban the tribal practice of clitoridectomy led to a rise in support for the anti-colonial movement known as the Mau Mau. Independence was achieved in 1962, and the practice of female genital mutilation continues. It does so too in Egypt, where it was condemned at a UN conference on population control held in Cairo in September 1994 as a violation of the basic human right to bodily integrity. After two little girls bled to death following botched clitoridectomies in 1996, President Mubarak's government banned it. But popular support for mutilating girls remains strong. "Am I supposed to stand around while my daughter chases men?" Saeed Ibrahim, a farmer, was quoted as saying. "So what if some infidel doctor says it is unhealthy? Does that make it true? I would have circumcised my daughter even if they passed a death sentence against it. You know what honour is in Egypt. If a woman is more passive, it is in her interest, it is in her father's interest, and in her husband's interest." A 17-year-old teenager agreed. "Banning it would make women wild, like those in America," he was reported as saying. It is estimated that between 80% and 97% of girls have undergone some form of genital mutilation in Egypt. About 100 million women worldwide have suffered the procedure, and 2 million more undergo it each year, including 40,000 in immigrant communities in the United States, according to the Egyptian feminist Nawal Assad. However, the most momentous opposition to Western influence manifested itself in the Middle East in opposition to governmental efforts to outlaw the Islamic practice of veiling women. Misogyny is rarely noticed as a historical catalyst, yet it has played a sometimes profound role in helping to determine the course human affairs would take. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the long and bloody sequence of events that led to the September 11th attacks on the United States began 40 years earlier in a college in Afghanistan when an angry male student hurled acid in the face of a young woman student because she was not wearing the veil. His name was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and he would go on to help foment a rebellion against Afghanistan's reforming government that would first draw the Soviets and eventually the Americans into a brutal war against Muslim fundamentalists in which the US is engaged to this day. From the 19th century onwards, when Western influence on the Arab world began to challenge Muslim customs, the practice of veiling women has been at the centre of a contentious debate involving Westerners, Islamic reformers, Islamic nationalists, and Islamic fundamentalists. It has frequently provoked revolution, violence, and bloodshed. The West, in its drive to dominate and control Arab nations, held up veiling as proof of the backwardness and inherent inferiority of Islamic cultures. In response, those who fought against the colonial powers often seized on the custom as fundamental to the preservation of a Muslim identity as it confronted the overwhelming political, economic, and cultural might of the West. Meanwhile, women, whose welfare and status was supposedly at the heart of this battle, were ordered to veil or unveil at the dictate of whichever tendency had achieved hegemony. The West's concern for their treatment has usually not been allowed to interfere with the more important goal of domination. And always behind this and other arguments looms the question of Islam's inherent misogyny. It would indeed be a miracle if a religion so closely related as Islam is to both Christianity and Judaism did not exhibit powerful misogynistic tendencies. Islam, after all, accepts the biblical tradition as one of divine revelation, including its misogynistic stories about women. The fall of man myth is as important in Islam as it is in Judaism and Christianity as the key to explaining woman's lower status. While early Islam accorded women some rights that were denied them under Christianity, such as the right to inherit property, Muhammad, 570 to 632, adopted other practices, including polygamy, seclusion, and veiling, that adversely affected how women were viewed and treated. In the years following the death of Muhammad, as Arab armies swept as conquerors into the Middle East and North Africa, women were removed from public life, segregation was instituted during prayers, and stoning introduced as a punishment for adultery. At the same time, Islamic civilization was reaching a peak of intellectual, scientific, and artistic splendor. It preserved the learning of the ancient world and transmitted it back to the barbarians who had triumphed in the West after the fall of Rome. Sir Richard Burton, the 19th century explorer and translator of the Arabic erotic masterpiece The Perfumed Garden, described Baghdad, which stood at the heart of this culture, as the centre of human civilization, which was then confined to Greece and Arabia, and the metropolis of an empire exceeding in extent the widest limits of Rome, essentially a city of pleasure, a Paris of the 9th century. As in the Kama Sutra of India, woman in the perfumed garden is celebrated for the beauty of her sexuality, and the book, like the earlier Indian and Chinese works on eroticism, is a guide to achieving sexual satisfaction for both men and women. "Praise be given to God," it begins, "who has placed man's greatest pleasure in the natural parts of woman, and has destined the natural parts of man to afford the greatest enjoyment to woman." This unashamed and explicit recognition of woman's sexuality puts Islam, erotically speaking, closer to the Eastern tradition than to Christianity, with its consistent repression of the body. But it would not be the first time that such recognition, as well as respect for learning and the arts, coexisted alongside intellectual, spiritual, and social contempt for women. From the 8th century onwards, the word for woman became synonymous with the word for slave. However, Islam absorbed many local customs and traditions as it expanded, so that scholars argue that it is difficult to isolate misogynistic or discriminatory practices that are specific to Islamic cultures. For instance, polygamy, veiling, and seclusion were long-established features of the higher echelons of Byzantine society. The Islamic medieval theologian Ghazali, 1058-1111, expressed the same familiar misogyny as his Christian and Jewish counterparts when he stated, "It is a fact that all the trials, misfortunes, and woes which befall men come from women." He lists the 18 punishments women must suffer as a result of Eve's disobedience. Among them are menstruation, childbirth, and pregnancy. But he is careful to go beyond the biological to include in the list purely social customs deeply prejudicial to women, such as not having control over her own person, her liability to be divorced and inability to divorce, it's being lawful for a man to have 4 wives but for a woman to have only 1 husband, the fact that she must stay secluded in the house, the fact that she must keep her head covered inside the house, that 2 women's testimony has to be set against the testimony of 1 man, the fact that she must not go out of the house unless accompanied by a near relative. By making a social custom an expression of the will of God, Ghazali gives it the power of religious sanction. Some, but not all of these customs, have been traced back to Muhammad. But Ghazali represents a conservative consolidation of Islamic thinking about women. One leading Arabic historian can name only one major Muslim scholar, Ibn al-Arabi, 1165-1240, as being sympathetic to women, and calls him probably unique. With the decline of Arab power and the growing penetration of the Middle East by Europe and then the United States, such practices, or punishments, as Ghazali has it, represented the lowly status and cruel treatment of Middle Eastern women. They became part of the propaganda war that was and is being waged between the West and its Islamic opponents. Contradictions, inconsistencies, and at times downright duplicity have ever been a part of the West's engagement with Muslim nations. The British, who occupied Egypt in 1882, condemned veiling as part of the backwardness from which they were trying to rescue Egyptians, yet at the same time cut funding for education for girls. Efforts at economic reform in Iran in 1951 fell victim to Cold War rivalries when the CIA and Britain orchestrated a coup that restored dictatorial power to the Shah. Egypt gained independence from Britain in 1953 after a political uprising in which women played a prominent role. It brought President Gamal Abdel Nasser, 1918-70, to power. In 1956, he granted a limited form of suffrage to women. The same year, the British, French, and Israelis invaded Egypt after Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. Though he became increasingly dictatorial, Nasser remained a figure of popular esteem because he was viewed as someone who stood up to Western aggression. The opposite was true of the Shah of Iran. After 1951, Islamic fundamentalists saw his modernizing program, which included banning the veil, as a sellout to the Western powers. This provoked a huge demonstration of women in Tehran in 1979, demanding the right to wear the veil. The same year, the Islamic Revolution in Iran put the Ayatollah Khomeini in power. He imposed severe restrictions on women, removing them from public life as he pursued his aim of reversing the gains made under the Shah's reign. The new laws included a punishment of 74 lashes for defying the new dress code, requiring them to be veiled at all times when in public. They reduced Iranian women to the status of privatized sex objects required to be at the disposal of their husbands at all times. Women accused of violating the restrictions were exposed to male violence, and gangs of fundamentalists attacked them in the street if they were judged inadequately covered. The legal system was overhauled and became a codified misogyny. Women judges were dismissed, and evidence from women witnesses was not allowed unless corroborated by men. Women were barred from attending law school. The marriageable age for a girl was dropped from 18 to 13. Since the Ayatollah was an enemy of the United States, his conduct towards women was held up as an example of the barbarism of Islam and proof of the need for a strong Western deterrent in the Middle East, while it was conveniently forgotten that the West's complicity in supporting the Shah's dictatorship against its democratic opponents was at least partly to blame for the Islamic backlash. Further east in Pakistan, a similar reaction to Westernization was underway. In 1980, under the dictatorship of General Zia al-Haq, veiling was enforced. women were declared to be the root and cause of corruption, and working women were especially condemned for being responsible for a collapse in morality and the disintegration of the family. The new regime wanted them retired and pensioned off. The pronouncements have a familiar ring, echoing the propaganda of the Nazi Party in Germany in the 1930s in its drive to force women back to their proper sphere of domestic imprisonment. An Islamic advisor to the government advocated that women should never leave the confines of their homes except in an emergency. The state came close to abolishing rape as a crime when its expert on Islamic law argued that while women are visible in the public sphere, no man should be punished for rape. In other words, it is understandable if a man seeing a woman in public is overcome with lust and rapes her, since she has no business being seen outside her home in the first place. If rape did occur, then a woman needed four male witnesses before she could bring a case to court. Women's testimony and that of non-Muslims are not admissible. The misogynistic bias of the court is blatant, since it has to be supposed that any woman who brings a rape charge must have been outside the control of her male guardian when attacked, which immediately puts her behaviour in a suspicious light. Though the harsh government of General Zia is over, its misogynistic legacy lives on. In May 2002, a 26-year-old woman was sentenced to death by stoning after she had brought a charge of rape against her brother-in-law. Zafran Bibi, who gave birth to a baby girl while her husband was in jail, told the court that she was repeatedly sexually assaulted by his brother Jamal Khan, either on the hillside behind her home in the remote mountain country of Pakistan near the Afghan border, or in her farm when she was alone. Applying Islamic law, the judge said, "The lady stated before this court that, yes, she had committed sexual intercourse, but with the brother of her husband. This left no option to the court but to impose the highest penalty." Mr. Khan walked free without being charged. Human rights workers said that even if the death penalty was annulled, Ms. Bibi faced a term of between 10 and 15 years imprisonment for having illegal sex. Pakistan courts make little distinction between consensual sex and rape. Up to 80% of all women in Pakistani prisons are there because they have been convicted under Islamic laws against adultery. It is reported that girls as young as 12 or 13 face conviction and a public whipping if convicted of illegal sexual relations. Nearly half of all women who report rape end up convicted of adultery. The law actively discourages women from bringing a charge of rape, but if they do not and become pregnant, they can be convicted of adultery. A few weeks after the Zafran Bibi case caught the eye of the media, that of Mukhtaran Bibi, no relation, came to light on the other side of Pakistan, in the Punjab district. She was gang-raped on the orders of the local village council because her younger brother had been accused of forming a relationship with a higher-caste woman. After a public outcry, however, the police charged six men in connection with the rape. The state awarded Mukhtaran Bibi just over $8,000 in compensation. Normally, the vast majority of cases such as this go unreported. However brutal and repressive to women Iran and Pakistan were, events there would prove merely a prelude to what was to happen in Afghanistan, where perhaps for the first time in history a state came into being, the primary purpose of which was to enact, politically, socially and legally, a misogynistic vision of terrifying cruelty. Afghanistan has impressed itself upon the imagination of the West because the men who flew their hijacked aircraft into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania were largely products of the training camps established there over the last few decades by fundamentalist Muslims. Mohammed Atta, believed to have crashed Flight 11 into the Trade Center's North Tower just before 9 a.m. on the morning of the 11th of September 2001, stipulated in his will that no women would be allowed to touch his body or even attend his last rites. In fact, his inhuman crime, with ghastly irony, ensured that his atoms intermingled with those of many hundreds of women in the conflagration and collapse that the crash caused. That Atta was a misogynist is no coincidence. Misogyny is an essential part of the worldview of the Muslim terrorists trained in the mountains of Afghanistan with whom America is now at war, just as it is a crucial ingredient in the recent history of that unhappy land. The thread that runs through the recent history of Afghanistan, linking it to the attacks of 9/11, is the ferocious resistance to any attempt to have women treated as human beings. Since 1959, when a reforming government decreed that women were no longer required to veil, Islamic fundamentalists have been at the center of that resistance. Sometimes they have collaborated with various nationalist groups, as well as a patchwork of tribal alliances. These have united periodically to fight a common enemy, before invariably turning their weapons on each other. Afghan women obtained the vote in 1964. At this point, Afghanistan was more progressive than most Muslim nations. In cities such as Kabul, some girls were allowed to attend school. Nonetheless, the vast majority of women remained illiterate, and those who did dare seek an education faced fundamentalist fanatics such as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, whose first memorable action as a mujahideen or holy warrior was when he commanded a group that threw acid in the faces of young women who attended school unveiled. Later, his men crucified a young woman student whose naked and bisected body was found nailed to the doors of a classroom in Kabul University. The United States only really began to pay attention to Afghanistan when pro-Soviet socialists staged a coup against the government in 1978. The new regime's efforts at reform, often aimed at bettering the position of women, were fiercely resisted, and support for Islamic fundamentalism grew. This prompted the Soviet Union to intervene in late 1979. From this point, the United States firmly supported Hekmatyar, who by that time was a puppet of the fundamentalist Pakistani regime of General Zia-ul-Haq. Under the Reagan administration, billions of dollars were funneled through the Pakistani Secret Service to Hekmatyar and his supporters. More moderate mujahideen were never bankrolled to the same extent. The Soviets were forced to withdraw in 1989 after a bloody war, though Hekmatyar's contribution to their defeat has been disputed. U.S. policymakers obviously assumed that communists were more dangerous than misogynists. History would prove them wrong. The movement known as the Taliban emerged out of the chaos that followed the Soviet withdrawal. It was made up mainly of religious students trained in the madrasas or Quranic schools of Pakistan. Its roots lay in Deobandism, an ultra-conservative tendency in Islam that dated back to the 19th century and came from northern India. It taught a strict, literalist reading of the Quran. Misogyny was to the Taliban what anti-Semitism was to the Nazis, the very core of their ideology. As they spread their rule from Kandahar in the south to Kabul in the north, women were systematically driven from the public sphere. In a long series of decrees, the misogynistic equivalent of the Nazis' Nuremberg laws against German Jews, women were forbidden to work, go to school, attend male doctors, wear makeup or any form of decoration, appear in public unless accompanied by a male relative, and completely covered from head to toe in a burqa, the dark veil of opaque cloth attached to a close-fitting cap which completely encloses a woman's body. Only a peephole at eye level allows any light into this walking tomb. Television was banned, as was music, dancing, and any form of entertainment. The radio droned out Quranic prayers and what seemed like a never-ending stream of restrictions and edicts such as, "Public transport will provide buses reserved for men and buses reserved for women. Women and girls are forbidden to wear brightly coloured clothes beneath the chadri, dark veils. A woman is not allowed to go to a tailor for men. A girl is not allowed to converse with a young man. Infraction of this law will lead to the immediate marriage of the offenders. Women are not allowed to speak in public because their voices arouse men. Women engaged to be married may not go to a beauty parlour, even in preparation for their weddings. Merchants are forbidden to sell female undergarments." Men, too, were targeted. They were forced to grow beards and wear a white cap or turban. Nobody was allowed to display photographs or have their photograph taken, even at festive occasions such as weddings. It was against the law to whistle. The Taliban even found Quranic justification for banning whistling kettles. This was literalism gone mad. But however absurd or insane their decrees, the Taliban enforced them with frightening cruelty. Their moral police, under the aegis of the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, patrolled the streets. They attacked two women on a Kabul street and beat them senseless with whips. Their crime? Wearing white shoes under their burqas, a gesture seen as an insult to the flag of the Taliban, which is white. Another Kabul woman was seized in the street and denounced. Her crime? Wearing nail polish. Her fingers were cut off on the spot. Women were flogged for going out alone. Two women convicted of adultery were dragged to the sports stadium in Kabul, which had become a public execution ground. Before a large crowd, they were shot in the back of the head. As one young woman who lived through this nightmare expressed it, "Even though they seem to follow one another without rhyme or reason, these decrees have a certain logic, the extermination of the Afghan woman." "The Taliban," she wrote, "tried to steal my face from me, to steal the faces of all women." Women fought back. One woman opened a secret beauty salon in Kabul. Her patrons came and went with the surreptitiousness of conspirators bent on some dreadful revolutionary act. In fact, that is what putting on makeup had become. Others opened schools for girls in their apartments. Girls were advised to carry some religious tract with them at all times, and if the apartment was raided, religious works were always on hand, in the hope that the morals police could be persuaded that the children were undergoing only religious instruction. Shortly after the occupation of Kabul in September 1996, the Taliban debated whether or not the peepholes in the chadri were too big. The veil had turned a woman's face into a sexual organ, and it has to be negated, denied, and repressed at all costs. Not only woman herself, but anything to do with her is infused with her sexuality, especially her clothes, which the Taliban will not touch. A man, his wife, and daughter were fleeing the country. He avoided having his suitcases searched simply by telling the Taliban guards, "This is my wife's suitcase, and these belong to my daughters," and the guard steps back. Rarely has the horror and fear of the female body expressed itself so eloquently or manifested itself so explicitly. Some have sought explanations for this misogyny in the nature of Islam itself. It is easy to dig out quotations from various mullahs condemning women's beauty as evil and the work of the devil. But in this, the Islamic tradition is in fact little different from that of Christianity and Judaism. It shares with them a common inheritance rich in misogyny, though in works such as The Perfumed Garden, it incorporated the erotic influence of the East in a way the Christian tradition never has. The historical traditions to which Islam is heir were no doubt influential, but an explanation for such unrelenting misogyny as the Taliban embodied must be sought elsewhere. The Taliban have been compared to an all-male brotherhood of holy warriors like that of the medieval crusaders. A more recent parallel might be drawn with the origins of the Nazi Party, whose policy towards women was aimed at driving them out of the public sphere into a domestic prison where they were expected to perform their only true function, reproduction. Both the Taliban and the Nazis were products of war, disillusionment, and frustration. The Taliban emerged from the Pakistani refugee camps, where millions of Afghanis had fled during the war against the Soviets, and the all-male world of the religious schools that wealthy Saudis set up and funded in Pakistan to teach a reactionary form of Islam deeply hostile to the West. Many who flocked to these schools were orphans, with little or no contact with women. In the Taliban, this all-male world would consolidate into one that was profoundly antagonistic to women, and not a little afraid of them. Both movements attracted men brutalized by years of death and destruction, men whom humiliation had embittered. For the Germans who joined the National Socialists, Germany's defeat in the First World War was the catalyst of their anger. For those who joined the Taliban, it was the humiliation of their country and its traditions at the hands of lawless brigands funded by America, and more broadly, the humiliation of Islam as the influence of the West spread throughout the Middle East. The Nazis had the beer halls, an all-male domain like that of the trenches, the veterans and paramilitary associations that they created after the war. For the Taliban, the Quranic schools exercised a comparative function, where their anger and frustration could coalesce into an ideology whose misogyny is so extreme that it does not pass the test of sanity. Had an individual expounded such doctrines, he would have been regarded, quite rightly, as insane. But as has been noted before, once religion sanctions a belief, our ordinary notions of what distinguishes the insane from the sane are thrown out the window. As in the all-male milieu of the Nazis, it is not surprising to find also a strong homoerotic element among the Taliban. Shortly after the fall of the Taliban in late 2001, an American journalist visiting their stronghold of Kandahar was surprised to find a photography shop with photographic portraits of Taliban fighters, some of whom were wearing eyeliner. He learned that it was not uncommon for these fundamentalists to do what was utterly forbidden to women, paint their finger and toenails with henna. Some even wore high-heeled sandals, which gave them a mincing, feminine gait. These Talibanettes were tolerated in the capital of a state that brutalized and mutilated women for putting on makeup, and where the official punishment for homosexuals was to use bulldozers to crush and bury them alive. Hypocrisy is inevitable when moral restrictions defy human nature. Unfortunately, hypocrisy also remains a fundamental part of the West's relationship to the Muslim world. Until after 9/11, the governments of the West largely ignored the Taliban's violations of human rights and the many atrocities that they were responsible for that were specifically aimed at women. In February 1997, the French government invited the Taliban Minister for Health, Mullah Mohammed Abbas, to Paris, where, on the very day that two women were executed in Kabul for committing adultery, he was received by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the President of the National Assembly. "A minister for health," commented one Afghan woman, "who bars women from hospitals, who forced women doctors and nurses out of work, and closed daycare centres." Abbas was an uneducated mullah who was not even a doctor. The invitation caused some Afghan women to despair that if France is welcoming a Talib, that means the Taliban propaganda has worked. In May 2001, just 4 months before the attacks on the United States, President George W. Bush congratulated the Taliban because they had cracked down on opium production and compensated them for the loss of revenues with a check for $43 million. All this time, the Taliban were providing facilities for training the men, followers of Osama bin Laden, who would attack the United States and its allies. There was some satisfaction in knowing that in the American airstrikes against Taliban targets that began in October 2001, at least one of the pilots involved was a woman. But it is, in the end, small compensation for the decades of misguided policies the West has pursued that helped create the Taliban in the first place. In the years since the fall of the Taliban, the United States and its allies have been funding health and education schemes for women in an attempt to repair the havoc the years of war and fundamentalism have wrought on the medical and school systems. Maternal mortality in Afghanistan is at catastrophic levels, a UNICEF official reported a year after the Taliban had fled. In one province, between 1998 and 2002, 64% of women of reproductive age who died did so from complications associated with pregnancy. The efforts to educate girls has seen improvised schools opening in remote rural areas, as well as a resurgence of schools in the big cities. However, Afghanistan remains unsettled and the fundamentalist threat still thrives. In late 2002, 4 girls' schools were attacked in villages south of Kabul. Near one, a message was left which warned, "We call on all our countrymen to save their clean sisters and daughters from this infidel net. Stop carrying out the plans of the Americans, or you will face further deadly attacks." Local police said the attackers were either Taliban supporters or those still loyal to Hekmatyar. One of the lessons of Afghanistan, and of the Middle East in general, is that the treatment of women is not a foreign policy issue for the United States unless, as under George W. Bush, there is the prospect of aid money going to family planning clinics that offer abortion services. Misogyny, unlike racism, is never an issue when Washington's foreign policy hawks survey the global balance and pick their allies and their enemies. Women's rights continued to be denied systematically in states such as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan that are close allies to the United States. Yet, unlike racism, misogyny is regarded as a quaint, if sometimes upsetting, cultural trait with which outsiders do not interfere. It is like the days, not too long ago, when wife-beating was a domestic dispute that was nobody's business. Our recent history should have made one thing clear. Women's rights are human rights. Any foreign policy that fails to recognize this effectively dehumanizes half the human race.